Welcome to the Fulham Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 8:34 Greenwich Mean Time. Today is February 22nd, and today being Friday, it's the big picture long-term audio for the various different asset classes. And if we have a review of what's been happening this week, it really has been quite eventful. On the one hand, the Dow Jones posted a downside key reversal on Wednesday, followed through a little bit on Friday, and then is up about 100 points as we approach the close here on Friday evening. Now, the Dow has been ranging in the region of 14,000 for much of the last month, and maybe a bit more than that. And 14,000 is a bit of a big number because it represents the region of the 2007 high. And the Dow has been outperforming the S&P by a considerable margin over the last decade, because the S&P 500 has been largely range-bound, and it's currently in the region of 1,512. And that 1,500 area has been where the S&P has been ranging with an upward bias over the last month. And we've characterized what's been happening in stock markets as a reaction for some and a correction for others over the last month. And where the correction has been most focused has been in Europe. And in Europe, we saw this week that a number of markets pulled back sharply, and they're a bit steadier in here at the end of the week. So the CAC, having pulled back sharply intra-week, is up today by over 2%, and the DAX is up over 1% at the close of the week. And the fact that we're getting some backing and filling, and the fact that, and just to put that, just to define what I mean by that we're not going down on consecutive days, but that the market is falling and then recovering a good part of the decline and spending a bit of time ranging, is consistent with mean reversion. And the action that we've had is consistent with a reaction and consolidation phase following what has been a remarkably good start to the year, and not least since markets have been really rallying since the end of November. And that's an important consideration. So we've had a fantastic run, and we've seen that a number of markets have rolled over into a reaction consolidation. And when we look at Asia, the Nikkei is finishing out the week in the region of 11,300, a little bit shy of 11,400. And the yen has moderated its decline over the last number of weeks. It had an explosive decline in the beginning of the year, and that has given way to a step sequence decline now, particularly against the US dollar. And provided that remains the case, and considering that the G20 made no move to castigate Japan's actions, we can anticipate that the yen's devaluation will persist. Well, then that will act as a continued tailwind for Japanese equities over not just the short term, but over the medium term. The fact that the banking sector has begun to find support, and that the small cap sector, the second section, which is so often a leader for Japan, has found support and is rallying again, is really quite supportive of the medium term bullish action in Japanese equities, and that is likely to persist. This week was also notable for what happened in China, and the Chinese are combating a reflating housing market, and they simply can't afford to allow a housing bubble to inflate any further in China. It's a threat to social stability, because houses are getting beyond the reach of normal people, and they're already beyond the reach of a lot of people, particularly in tier one cities. So they've instituted a number of measures to try and bring down the price of housing, and some of that has impacted the banking sector. And the bank sector is where the focus of supports have been over the last 3 and 4 months. So that has had an impact on the stock market. Now, the stock market has pulled back pretty sharply in the last 3 days. And when we look at it over the last 5 years, then the A-share index has been trending lower and pretty consistently for 2.5 years. And the rally that we've had in the last 3 months broke that downtrend, and we're now getting an unwind of the short-term overbought condition. But if this is a new bull market, and if the recovery is to be given the benefit of the doubt, then the market will find support in the region of the 200-day moving average. And we're not that far away from it right now, considering the size of the downward dynamic that we had yesterday. So China is certainly worth watching. And whereas we continue to see that Japan is extending additional liquidity, and Europe has little choice but to continue to make liquidity available, not least because the banking sector remains fragile, the Eurozone economy is in a recession, and they're just about to bail out Cyprus. So that would suggest that liquidity in Europe is going to remain abundant, and the UK is flirting with recession. So the Bank of England has made no secret of the fact that it is willing to stand ready to add additional liquidity. And a great deal of discourse has focused on the likelihood of the Fed ending its quantitative easing program. And there isn't a great deal of evidence to support it at present. At some point, we are going to see the Fed removing its quantitative easing, and interest rates will rise as a result of that. The question is whether that's going to happen in the short term or over the medium term. And there doesn't really look to be any prospect of it happening in the first quarter, and probably not even the second quarter of this year. As we approach the other half of the year, we'll see just how well the US economy is prevailing. Now, that's going to have an impact on asset markets. And of course, when we look at the role of liquidity, and particularly the role of the remarkable events that have taken place in the last number of years, where central bank balance sheets have literally exploded, then we can see that it is assets that depend most on the availability of cheap liquidity that will be most likely to be affected when that liquidity is withdrawn. Corporate bond spreads have contracted really quite considerably in the last number of years. And at the same time, corporates have been using this opportunity to increase the supply of those bonds. And while AAA, AA, and even A-rated securities are probably not going to represent a default probability, the fact that we've had such a compression of high yield spreads does suggest that there could be a problem in that sector when liquidity is eventually withdrawn. And the mortgage REIT sector, which depends on a low prepayment rate and access to credit to fund leveraged plays in mortgage bonds, will come under pressure when interest rates start to rise once more. So what's happening in the government bond markets is very interesting. We're right at the present moment at about 2% for US 10-year treasuries, and we've been there for about the last month, and yields have got a little bit weaker in here in the last couple of weeks, so prices have recovered somewhat. Yields would really need to push back below the 200-day moving average to question supply dominance. We can anticipate that government bond prices will be reasonably steady as long as stock markets are in this reactionary phase. But the rally so far in treasuries, and indeed government bonds more generally, has been pretty unimpressive. And whereas the pullback that we've seen in Europe has been really the leader in terms of the reaction, what we've been presented with elsewhere has been more of a consolidation of powerful gains, which has yet to end. And when we look at the rest of Asia, Indonesia, the Philippines, Thailand have been relatively unaffected by the reaction and consolidation that we've seen in other markets, and they're becoming increasingly susceptible to a pullback and consolidation. And that's particularly the case for the Philippines and Thailand. Indonesia probably has more underneath it to sustain an upward break. But these are also the markets that have been leading to the upside since 2008. And they bottomed well ahead of the wider market, and they've been leading to the upside throughout. And they're the epicenter of what is the really big theme of the decade, which is the rise of the global middle class. And it's interesting this week that Walmart announced a rather impressive performance in the fourth quarter. And while it expects the first quarter of this year to be a little bit more difficult, when one looks at the balance sheet, really Walmart was a North American company until about the last 4 or 5 years. But now all of its growth is coming from its international division. And Walmart is in the UK, Walmart is in China, and there's an increasing likelihood that Walmart is going to be in India. And its international division makes up approximately 29% of its total revenues now, and it's its fastest growing division. And in fact, if you look at the pretty staid performance of revenues right across North America, then the company depends on its international division to fuel growth. The fact that it is growing, and growing at really quite an impressive rate, is supportive of a whole slew of other types of companies. And one of the perceptions that has been changing as a result of this massive increase in the number of global consumers is in the perception of the consumer staples. Because more generally, they have been considered pretty staid, defensive type companies, and they generally have pretty high yields. But what we've seen is that the consumer staples is actually a very large growth sector when we take into account that the global economy is being presented with an additional 2 billion consumers in the last decade, and probably an additional another 2 billion consumers in the next decade. And the types of products that people in the West take for granted and as boring and as staples are the types of things that people strive for and work towards and aspire to owning in the developing world. And that's at least part of the reason that Warren Buffett was willing to pay up to pay all-time highs for Heinz shares, not because it was particularly cheap, but because it represented a growth avenue for revenues on a global basis. And that's likely to remain a theme common to those particular types of shares, where they're supplying the kinds of products that people just take for granted. And it is everything from convenience foods to cosmetics to sanitation products, and just about anything you might find in your bathroom or kitchen. And that's likely to be a major growth story rather than a defensive type sector. And there's no mistake and there's no coincidence that that has been one of the best performing sectors in the global economy over the last 3 and 4 years. And we've seen this week alone that a considerable number of these types of companies have been breaking out and hitting new all-time highs. So yes, we are presented with short-term overbought conditions, but we're seeing that a considerable number of these companies are hitting new all-time highs. And that's not something that we have seen every day with these types of companies. And it's really only been happening in the last few months, where we've seen that some of these shares have been ranging for 14 years, and now they're starting to break upwards. And this constitutes base formation completion. And if we're looking at that, then we're talking about a new secular bull market. And it's being led by the global consumer. And that is having a big impact on not only stock markets, but on the global economy more generally. And What's also interesting that is that, at least I found it interesting, earlier this week I reverse engineered a chart of the number of shares outstanding on the New York Stock Exchange. And it's not a particularly easy figure to come across. And I had to reverse engineer it from the percentage of net shorts, because that is an index that they produce. And the kind of data that came up from that is that, on the one hand, back in the 1990s, we saw that the number of shares listed on the NYSE doubled. And that was consistent with one of the biggest bull markets in history. And after 2000, the number of shares being issued on the index collapsed, which was consistent with the recessions. And of course, fee income for the exchanges disappeared. And with it, that also created an incentive for those exchanges to go out and find an additional source of revenue, and they embraced high-frequency traders and offered co-location and a range of other services, which contributed to volatility, and that contributed to a loss of faith in the capital formation capabilities of stock markets and a loss of faith in equities more generally because of that volatility. And the fact that we've had two crashes in the last decade has led to a response from legislators. So the regulatory burden and the compliance burdens of publicly limited or publicly available companies has risen substantially. And the net result of quantitative easing, low interest rates, and added compliance and volatility in stock markets is that there's been an incentive for companies to delist, to take one another over using debt rather than issuing new shares, and for management buyouts and private equity, so that the number of shares on the NYSE fell by about 13% in the last year and a half, and it remains on a downward trajectory. And that means that the supply of shares is decreasing in an environment where some of the largest companies are completing more than decade-long ranges. So we're actually given evidence that the shares of these globally oriented companies are turning into collector's items. And what people have been taught over the last 4 years has been to ride the rallies for as long as they last and get leveraged on the way up and take your profits at the first sign of trouble. And we've seen these remarkably persistent advances, which have been followed by really quite violent pullbacks. But if we're seeing that an increasing number of these companies are breaking out to new all-time highs, driven by growth in their global businesses and demand for their competitive yields, then these are buy and hold type companies, not trading vehicles. And the fact that we're seeing that the actual supply of their shares is decreasing rather than increasing is a powerfully attractive attribute of these shares. And we have exactly the opposite situation in government bonds, where the supply of those bonds has been increasing at a prodigious rate, and investors have been falling over themselves to accept negative real interest rates. And while one can make a very tenuous argument that that represents value, what it really represents is a momentum move, which is completely dependent on the support of governments. And that will end at some point, and yields will rise. And anyone who's got a long position or a leveraged long position in government bonds is really going to feel a great deal of pain. And gold is at an interesting juncture. It's pulled back by almost $200 in the last 6 weeks, and it's currently sitting at $1,579, and it was as low as $1,550 earlier on yesterday, and we've had a bit of a bounce since then. The supply of gold has not increased, and we've had a great deal of trouble among miners to keep their costs down and to increase the supply of the commodity. But gold is immutable, and that is one of its most attractive qualities, because all the gold that has ever been mined still exists in one form or another. And that is one of the reasons that it is considered the only real money. But at the same time, there is such a large amount of it now held in investment accounts and in ETFs that all of that inventory represents potential supply when people eventually come to sell. And it means that one of its most attractive qualities will also be the eventual undoing of the bull market. And we've been rallying in gold for 10 years. So this is a mature market. And considering the extent to which the Dow gold ratio has already contracted, the Dow has gone from 40 times the price of gold back in 1999 to give or take about 8. But we're now in big number territory, because to go from 8 to 7 or from 8 to 5 requires some very, very large moves in the two constituents, the Dow and gold. And that means that if gold is going to get back to the type of ratio value that it did compared to the Dow back in 1980 and back in the early 30s, then it is relying on a mania to take hold. And that means that gold prices would need to find support here and push back up to and above 1700 to begin to suggest that demand is returning to dominance, and then breaking up above 1800 and 1900. And the pullback that we've had in the last month has been very debilitating to sentiment, and the number of people calling the end of the bull market has increased substantially given the speed of the decline. And one can also look on these people as talking bears, and people with short positions have a vested interest in the market going lower. But we are back in an area of potential support, and this $1,550 area is the lower side of an 18-month range. And gold has had these 18-month ranges previously, although in those other ranges, by this juncture, it had improved substantially to the upper side of its range prior to breaking out, rather than testing the lower side. So this really is a very important juncture. And one of the reasons that people have been so... one of the reasons people bought gold in the first place was because it was a supply inelasticity story. And that supply inelasticity argument is tenuous when there is so much investment demand, when investment demand has moved to such a large proportion of the market in the last decade. One of the other reasons for owning gold is because of its long history as real money. And for people that are buying for that reason, then they accept that it will fluctuate in value. And other people were buying it as a hedge against central bank money printing. And central banks are still printing money. And what we've had in the last couple of weeks has been the beginning of a discussion about when some of that liquidity needs to be withdrawn. But one thing that we can be absolutely sure of is that when the decision is eventually taken to begin withdrawing some of the liquidity rather than perpetually increasing the amount of liquidity, they're going to do it very tentatively. And when we eventually do start to see interest rates rising, they're going to be well telegraphed, and they're going to be very tentative, because while there are signs that the US economy in particular is open to higher growth rates, not least because of a competitive advantage in energy prices and the fact that the spread between wage rates in North America and in Asia, particularly China, has compressed somewhat in the last 4 or 5 years. And also because high energy prices have made transportation between Asia and North America 3 times more expensive in the last decade. So that the application of technology such as industrial automation and embedded chips and the commercialization of nanotechnology and even in the healthcare sector, it opens the door to massive productivity gains. And that has the promise of creating more growth than people have anticipated. And if that does start to pan out, and it is still very much a best case scenario, then the need for additional quantitative easing will be less. And if that does pan out, then the need for a hedge against profligate money printing will be less important. So gold in that regard is a less compelling situation. So if things do start to get better, then there won't be the need for quantitative easing and the less need for a hedge. Where we see a bullish pattern for gold is if that does not occur, and if demand for the yellow metal continues to trend higher in Asia in particular. But what we're presented with outside of those arguments at the moment is a very interesting level, because if it breaks down from here, then it's going to be asking very, very big questions about the consistency of what has been a very impressive uptrend. So it does need to find support here, and this really is where it needs to find support, and we do need to see upward dynamics. And I opened a long position yesterday because I think there's at least a chance it's going to bounce from here. And so far, it's at least steadied, but it needs to do a lot more than it's already done. And the fact that platinum and palladium have been leading to the upside was also questioned in here this week, with platinum pulling back really very sharply, and it's down. It's pulled back by almost $100 in the last 3 days. Palladium has been really quite a bit more, quite a bit steadier, but that is where also there is a big supply inelasticity argument and increasing demand in an industrial area. So regardless of what the arguments are, we need to deal with the reality that's provided with them by the market, and that means that gold is a bit more risky right now than it has been really at any time in the last 5 years. And I think with that, I will leave you for the evening, but I wish all the best to all of you.